Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Welcome once again, I think, to this public lecture series on history and business in China, Zhonghua Huazhi Luntan, organized by the Department of History and also the Asia Pacific Institute of Business at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, and also the Hong Kong Public Libraries system, I think, of the Leisure and Cultural Services Department of the government, and sponsored by the Lee Hai-sen Foundation. And every year, this lecture series brings to Hong Kong and to the Central Library eminent historians and scholars from locally and also from around the globe to deliver some exciting lectures. And tonight, I think for this year, tonight is our fifth lecture, and tomorrow we have our last one. And the speaker, I think, for these two lectures is a well-renowned historian, Professor Arif Delik. And a short introduction of Professor Delik. He was born in Mersin, Turkey, in 1940, and he has a bachelor degree, you can guess what, in electrical engineering. And then a PhD, a doctorate in history, I think, from the University of Rochester, New York. He now lives in Eugene, Oregon, in the United States. Professor Delik is a distinguished fellow of the Peter Ward Institute for Advanced Studies at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. He taught at Duke University for 30 years before moving in 2001 to the University of Oregon, where he served as night professor of social science and director of the Center for Critical Theory and Transnational Studies. He just recently retired, but remain a very active, I think, researcher and scholar. He has then since served as a visiting professor at the University of British Columbia, University of Victoria, also in Canada, University of California in Los Angeles, in Hong Kong, in Paris, in Taipei, or recently in Beijing. The list is just too long. Okay, so he's a global traveler too, and he's the editor of several major learned journals, and he's also the author of many monograph and history books. I think some of them, I think, are collected by our library with his autograph, and then the value of those the books will be doubled, or more than doubled, I think. These publications, I think, include Revolution and History, Origins of Marxist Historiography in China, Origins of Chinese Communism, Anarchism in the Chinese Revolution. I think recently there is about the translation of this anarchism book, I think, was on the news. Marxism in the Chinese Revolution, Schools and into Fields and Factories, Anarchists, Kuomintang and the Labor University in Shanghai. And also After the Revolution, Waking to Global Capitalism. And more recently, Global Modernity, Modernity in the Age of Global Capitalism. So you know the breadth and also the depth of Professor Derek's scholarship. Without much, I think, ado, I think you probably can check out those books on your own now. And tonight, I think Professor Delik will deliver a talk on historical reflections on globalization. And there is a sequel tomorrow at the same time. It's a globalization and China's national development. But let us do it once at a time, okay? And Professor Delik will deliver, I think, a talk for about 55 minutes, and then followed by a Q&A. So let us welcome Professor Delik and listen to his exciting speech.
Thank you very much, Professor Leung. I would like to thank the Department of History at the Chinese University of Hong Kong for honoring me with this invitation. I guess I should start by saying that since this is a series on business history, that even if I have dabbled in questions of culture and capitalism, I know very little about business history. So today, what I'm going to present is going to be reflections on the macro history of globalization. I guess that's the most accurate way of describing it. Few would question, I think, that let me know if any of this is too much. Few would question, I think, that there are certain important changes at work in the world, and more importantly, perhaps, in the ways in which we think about the world. Globalization as concept is intended to comprehend these changes. The term globalization may be ideologically packed. It may be misleading if taken literally, and some of the processes it purports to describe may not be novel at all. If we decide to avoid the term for some reason or another, we must be careful, nevertheless, not to ignore the changes that gave rise to it and give substance to its appeals. In the discussion below, I undertake two tasks. First is to place globalization in historical perspective, to elucidate what may be novel about contemporary globalization as phenomenon and as a conceptualization of the world. The second is the reverse of the first one, to reflect critically on the implications of a globalized perspective for history as a mode of ordering the past. It is my premise here that these two procedures are equally necessary if we are to avoid the ideological reification of globalization on the one hand, and on the other hand, its containment in the legacies of colonial modernity. It is necessary, if only tentatively, to distinguish globalization as a descriptive term referring to historical process from its deployment as a self-consciously new way of viewing the world, as a paradigm or discourse, in other words. It is arguable that globalization as historical process has been underway since the origins of humanity, gathering in scope, speed, and self-consciousness over the last few centuries, and entering a new phase in recent decades. But this teleological, evolutionary sense of globalization is not the only one available. Globalization may also represent a recurrent conjunctural phenomenon marked by advances and retreats over the course of time and derive its meaning not from reference to the entirety of human history but against the immediate past. Globalization, a self-conscious paradigm, it is equally arguable, is a product of the recent past and represents a departure from ways of conceiving the world that have been dominant for the past two centuries and shaped social, scientific, and cultural thinking over that same period. Fundamental to the shift may be the spatial turn in the conceptualization of modernity, or more accurately, the ascendancy of the spatial over the temporal, which is crucial to grasping the inescapable contradictoriness of the very idea of globalization as we currently confront it, and that also distinguishes it from earlier ways of conceiving the world. Receptivity, if not resignation, to the simultaneous fragmentation and unification of the world represents a break with modernity's ways of knowing. But it is not a return to some pre-modern condition either. for different claims to knowledge do not merely coexist presently in blissful obliviousness to other ways of knowing, but in conscious claims to domains of their own against other claims, which is itself a product of modernity. The implications of such unification / fragmentation for history is a question I would like to return to in the second half of this discussion. What Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels wrote in the middle of the 19th century might have seemed fantastic in their day, but it is an eerily apt description of ours. I quote, "The discovery of America, the rounding of the Cape, opened up fresh ground for the rising bourgeoisie. The East Indian and Chinese markets, the colonization of America, trade with the colonies, an increase in the means of exchange and in commodities generally, gave to commerce, to navigation, to industry, an impulse never before known. Modern industry has established the world market for which the discovery of America paved the way. The bourgeoisie, historically, has played a most revolutionary part. The bourgeoisie cannot exist without constantly revolutionizing the instruments of production, and thereby the relations of production, and with them, the whole relations of society. The need of a constantly expanding market for its products chases the bourgeoisie over the whole surface of the globe. It must nestle everywhere, settle everywhere, establish connections everywhere. The bourgeoisie has, through its exploitation of the world, given a cosmopolitan character to production and consumption in every country. All old established national industries have been destroyed or are daily being destroyed. They are dislodged by new industries, whose introduction becomes a life and death question for all civilized nations. By industries that no longer work up indigenous raw material, but raw material drawn from the remotest zones. Industries whose products are consumed not only at home, but in every quarter of the globe. In place of the old wants satisfied by the productions of the country, we find new ones requiring for their satisfaction the products of distant lands and climes. In place of the old local and national seclusion and self-sufficiency, we have intercourse in every direction, universal interdependence of nations. And as in material, so also in intellectual production. The intellectual creations of individual nations become common property. National one-sidedness and narrow-mindedness become more and more impossible, and from the numerous national and local literatures there arises a world literature. The bourgeoisie, by the rapid improvement of all instruments of production, by the immensely facilitated means of communication, draws all, even the most barbarian nations, into civilization. The cheap prices of its commodities are the heavy artillery with which it batters down all Chinese walls. It compels all nations, on pain of extinction, to adopt the bourgeois mode of production. It compels them to introduce what it calls civilization into their midst, that is, to become bourgeois themselves. In other words, it creates a world after its own image. End of quotation. Both material and cultural globalization are implicit in what Marx and Engels have to say concerning the effects of the expansion of European capitals. Giovanni Arrighi has argued that capital has been globalizing all along, even before there was a structured and structuring entity that could be recognized as a capitalist world system. Arrighi, in turn, draws on the work of Fernand Braudel, which, in its analysis of the emergence of a European world system, recognizes the existence of a multiplicity of regional world systems with their own interactions, insertion into which enabled the bourgeoisies of Europe first to construct a European world system and subsequently to create the economic and political institutions that enabled them to draw all these other world systems within the orbit of Europe to create a world system that was global in scope. The sociologist Roland Roberts has divided globalization in history into five phases. The germinal phase, 15th to the mid-18th centuries, the incipient phase, mid-18th century to the 1870s, the takeoff phase, 1870s to the mid-1920s, the struggle for hegemony phase, mid-1920s to the late 1960s, and the uncertainty phase, 1960s to the 1990s. His depiction as the uncertainty phase of the last period when globalization as paradigm came into its own is an interesting point to which we shall return. Of more immediate relevance here is the coincidence of globalization in this outline with the history of the capitalist world system, as world system analysts such as Immanuel Wallerstein would argue, and his identification as the takeoff phase of the half century from the 1870s when, quote, globalizing tendencies of previous periods and places gave way to a single inexorable form, end of quote. Robertson is not alone in endowing this particular period with formative significance. Paul Hurst and Graham Thompson, in their critique of the concept of globalization, point to the same period as a baseline against which to evaluate contemporary claims to globality and conclude that at least in terms of the volume and intensity of economic activity between nations and regions of the globe, it is difficult to argue that the last quarter of the 20th century represents more of a condition of globality than the last quarter of the 19th. A New York Times article goes further to suggest that in terms of trade, financial investments and transactions, and labor flows, the peak of globalization, quote, occurred a century ago, making the 20th century memorable in economic history, mostly for its retreat from globalization. In some respects, only now is the world economy becoming as interlinked as it was a century ago. End of quote. Similar evidence may be found in the realms of consciousness and culture. From the Suez to the Panama Canals, the second half of the 19th century witnessed the undertaking of grand projects intended to link together different parts of the world. The American railroad tycoon Edward Harriman visualized the railroad line that would encircle the globe, and to that end, organized an expedition to Alaska in 1899 to investigate the possibilities of building a bridge across the Bering Straits with imported Chinese and Japanese labor. That would be a first step in his project. Organizers of world fairs, prominent cultural commercial phenomena across Europe and the United States for nearly 100 years following the Crystal Palace exhibition in London in mid-19th century, viewed the fairs as encyclopedias of the world that brought together not just peoples and artifacts of the whole world, but the world's knowledges as well. It is also to this period that we owe the great museums that sought to bring within their walls for preservation and research the world, its many presents and its pasts. Why then did globalization have to wait for the end of the 20th century to emerge to the forefront of consciousness as a new way of comprehending the world? Or more precisely, if we focus not on the term but its substance, does globalization have the same effect and the same meaning at all times? Since globalization at every moment of its history involves not only integration but also differentiation. How do difference and the conceptualization of difference enter into the consciousness of globality? Which may be the most pertinent question in our understanding of globalization as paradigm. Comparison with late 19th century globality may be quite revealing in dealing with some of these questions. Such comparison, to be meaningful, needs to account for forces not just of integration, but also of differentiation. While we may perceive in both periods common globalizing forces of capital, there are nevertheless immense technological differences between the two periods that distinguish the one from the other, both in the scope and configurations of globality and the momentum of its processes. What I would like to take up here, however, are the political and cultural differences. The processes of economic globalization in the late 19th century coincided with the global diffusion of nationalism and colonialism, whereas contemporary globalization is not only post-colonial but also post-national, in the sense both of following upon global reorganization of societies into nations and also proliferating assaults on the nation-state. Culturally speaking, if we are to characterize the late 19th century as a period of intense globalization, we need also to note that this globalization was almost synonymous with the globalization of Euro-American norms. It is not that there was no recognition of difference at the time, but difference was hierarchized in a temporality in which Euro-American economic, political, social, and cultural norms represented the teleological end of history. While these assumptions by no means have disappeared from contemporary conceptualizations of globality, they now have to contend with alternative claims to modernity that draw on alternative historical trajectories. This breakdown of Eurocentric hegemony is crucial to grasping globalization as a paradigm. Nationalism and colonialism, in historical hindsight, were at once products and agents of Eurocentric globalization. This is quite evident in the case of colonialism, which followed from Euro-American expansion over the world, and also served to bring the colonized within a Euro-American orbit economically, politically, and culturally. It is less evident in the case of nationalism, especially the emergence of the nation-state, which, in its territorial presuppositions, seems to contradict the imperatives of globalization. A number of observers, prominent among them Robertson, have suggested, however, that the nation-state itself was a product of the prior emergence of interstate relationships, which more or less forced nationhood on a previously diverse set of political systems, ranging from the tribal to the imperial. The global spread of the nation form from the second half of the 19th century in turn contributed further to processes of globalization in two ways. First was the diffusion globally of the juridical principles regulating not only relationships between states, but also relationships between states and their constituencies. Second was the erasure in the name of national cultural homogeneity of local differences within the nation. That these processes took different paths in different places and remained incompletely realized should not distract us from the revolutionary role that they have played in the course of the 20th century. Nationalism and colonialism, even as they contributed to globalization, also divided the globe in new ways into national and colonial spaces, which represented a decline not just from globality, but more precisely a Eurocentric globality. They did not therefore undercut the vision of a Eurocentric end to history, either among the proponents or the opponents, especially the socialist opponents of a capitalist world order. The second half of the 19th century coincides with the emergence of the social and cultural sciences as we have known them, including history. A hierarchical ordering of global differences informed not only the division of labor among the emerging social sciences, but their content as well, as the peoples of the world were placed in the new order of knowledge according to their presumed distance from Euro-Americans and their potential for living up to universal political and cultural norms for which the reference was contemporary Euro-American, quote, civilization, unquote. The price of failure to live up to those norms would be not just marginality, but physical and or cultural extinction. More than any other realm, it is the world of culture and cultural assumptions about knowledge that points to radical differences between the worlds of the present and the late 19th century that are not to be captured by statistics on trade, investment, and labor flows. The scientists and even the environmentalists like John Muir, whom Edward Harriman gathered to accompany him on his expedition to Alaska, were there to gather botanical, zoological, and cultural artifacts because they were convinced that progress of the kind envisioned by Harriman would lead to the extinction of much that was in Alaska. The world fairs of the 19th and 20th centuries gathered peoples from around the world in their exhibits. But there was no question whatsoever about the hierarchies that shaped the exhibits. The organizers of those fairs were so assured of the supremacy of Euro-American capitalist modernity, with colonialism as its most cogent evidence, that it would have been impossible for them to imagine that 100 years later, the descendants of Geronimo and Sitting Bull, who were put on exhibit in different fairs, would be demanding the return of ancestral bones with which the scientists of the age were stuffing their museums. Conviction in the supremacy of Euro-American modernity justified a racial hierarchy backed by so-called scientific evidence that placed white Euro-Americans at the pinnacle of evolution, further bolstering their claims to supremacy. They had no need to think global any more than they did multicultural, because they were convinced that those around the globe who did not respond to the demands of reason and progress as they understood them would soon go out of existence. There is a wide range of answers to the question of the emergence of globalization as a paradigm at the end of the 20th century, most of them technology-driven and focused on the unification of the globe. One answer that's often ignored, that seems to me to clamor for a hearing, is that the awareness of globalization is at once the product of a making of a Eurocentric order of the world and of its breakdown, which now calls upon our consciousness to abandon the claims of Eurocentrism while retaining consciousness of globality, which would have been inconceivable without the same order. It was necessary, before globalization in this contemporary sense could emerge to the forefront of consciousness, for a Euro-American globality to lose its claims to universality as the end of history, which is evident in our day most conspicuously, not in the economic sphere, where those claims may still be sustained, but in the realms of culture and knowledge, which display a proliferation of alternatives to Eurocentrism. The latter, ironically, are voiced most strongly in societies empowered by success in the capitalist economy, the very products themselves of capitalist globalization. The cultures and the knowledges that they proclaim draw upon native pasts, but by no means point to a return to those pasts, as the pasts now revived are pasts that have been reorganized already by a consciousness of a century or more of social and political transformation. They are not just post-colonial and post-national, but perhaps even post-global, as cultural contention and competition is played out presently on a terrain that itself presupposes an uncertain globality. It may not be too surprising that the term globalization acquired prominence in discussions of political economy and culture, not just with the end of the Cold War, but with the increasing attention drawn to the emergence of new capitalist economies in the 1980s, most conspicuously in East and Southeast Asia. No less important is the fact that the emergence of these economies was accompanied by a reassertion of claims to cultural difference that had been submerged so long as these societies remained under the shadow of Europe and the United States. Contemporary conceptualizations of globalization based their claims to novelty on their break with modernization discourse grounded in capitalism and the alternative to it provided by socialist modernization. These two alternatives, ironically, shared a common commitment to developmentalism, and each sought to draw into its orbit the nations of the postcolonial world, themselves anxious to develop so as to overcome the legacies of colonialism and enhance national autonomy and power. The three worlds of modernization discourse all conceived of modernization in terms of national units, which disguised the fundamental ways in which both the three worlds idea and the idea of the nation were premised on prior assumptions and processes of globalization. It is nevertheless important to the distinction drawn here that globality was conceived of under the regime of modernization as internationalism rather than as globalism. The immediate context for contemporary forms and consciousness of globality is the breakdown of this mapping of the world. First, with the transformations that rendered increasingly questionable the idea of the third world, and subsequently with the abandonment and fall of the socialist alternative. Already in the late 1960s and early 1970s, important alternatives had emerged that questioned the nation-based culturalist assumptions of modernization discourse. As a new global situation emerged in the 1980s with transformations within capitalism, most importantly, the decentering of economic power with the appearance of competitors to the United States hegemony, the analysis of capitalism itself assumed greater complexity. Finally, as the post-Cold War promise of a new world order in the early 90s has given way to evidence of new kinds of disorder, drawing upon sources of identity that are as old as, if not older than, modernity, still other analyses of globality have become an urgent necessity. Globalization as paradigm, in short, represents both a recognition of the decentering of the world, which had to be centered before it could be decentered, including the world of capitalism, and also the institutions and knowledges that are necessary to manage and contain difference or even chaos. If globalization is to be subjected to the judgment of history, it seems only fair that history should be reviewed from the perspective of globalization as paradigm, which may reveal a great deal about both history and globalization. History, the anthropologist Nicholas Dirks once observed, is a sign of the modern. The emergence of a historical consciousness in Europe was inseparable from the emergence of a consciousness of modernity that called for a new ordering of the past as Europeans encountered a multitude of new peoples and new phenomena that called for inclusion in the account of humanity, which in turn called for a revisioning of the European past. In Discovering America, J.H. Eliot has written, Europe discovered itself. Eurocentrism was as much about the invention of Europe as it was about the ordering of the peoples of the world in a temporal scheme in which Europe represented the pinnacle of progress. And history was to bear witness to the European achievement. by the second half of the century at the hands of German historians, history was rendered into the organizing principle of all the natural and the human sciences. As George Eggers writes of German historicism, which was spread subsequently throughout Europe and North America, I quote, "The new outlook, later often referred to by the term historicism, was hailed as an intellectual advance. Historicism was more than a theory of history. It involved a total philosophy of life, a unique combination of a conception of science, specifically of the human or cultural sciences, and the conception of the political and social order. It assumed, as Ortega y Gasset formulated it, that, quote, man, in a word, has no nature. What he has is history," end of quote. "But also firmly believed that history revealed meaning, and that meaning revealed itself only in history. Seen in this way, history became the only way of studying human affairs." The late 19th century may have been the high point in the dominance of history. And as I have taken this period in the discussion above as a referent for the changing meaning of globalization, the contrast in the confidence in history then against the contemporary crisis of history may serve as further illustration of the wide gap between contemporary notions of globality and the global outlook that may have prevailed a century ago. There is little doubt about the current crisis in history, if more in the cultural meaning than in the professional practice of history. It is commonplace in the perspective of cultural studies to associate this crisis with postmodernism and postcolonialism. My own sense is that the crisis is rooted most fundamentally in a consciousness of globality. Indeed, there is much to be gained from viewing postmodernism and postcolonialism themselves as intellectual manifestations of an increasingly globalized consciousness since the 1960s. Postmodernism and postcolonialism, both residual concepts that derive their meaning from their relationship to the past, do not present themselves as viable candidates for a new paradigm that might enable us to grasp the present in its novelty. On the other hand, they make quite good sense as concepts of a transitional period when viewed from the perspective of globalization, which is a good bit to say about the present, but also illuminates the past in new ways. The contradictions incorporated into globalization as paradigm are visible in the conflicting visions of the past to which it has given rise, that range from renewed efforts to grasp the past in its totality, that also overcome the Eurocentrism of an earlier world historiography, to declarations of the end of history, to the fragmentation of the past into mutually irreconcilable narratives. To take up a question that seems particularly pertinent here, does the end of history for one serve as the beginning of history for others? And if so, what does this say about history? It may help demonstrate further the power of globalization as a paradigm at once of integration and disintegration, that what appears as the dissolution of history from one perspective appears as its recovery from another. It is possible, indeed, that globalization appears to a Euro-American intellectual as a radical break with the past in its repudiation of a Eurocentric teleology, that nevertheless retains in its most basic assumptions the vision of a world of unity, while from other perspectives, globalization means release from a hegemonic ideology of global unity that allows a choice once again of entry into a global stream of history on one's own terms, scrambling in the process the meaning of exactly what such a stream might mean. In either case, globalization from third world perspectives, at its most radical presently, entails a repudiation not just of a Eurocentric mapping of modernity, but of history itself, is a fundamental expression of Eurocentrism. The Indian psychologist Ashish Nandi has subjected history to harsh criticism as one corner of the triangular ideology of a Eurocentric modernity, along with science and developmentalism. Nandi's critique takes us far beyond the limited questions of who is to be included in history and how, to confront history and historical thinking as the problem. His argument is deceptively simple. History, as one mode of thinking about the past, present, and future, has been established in the modern world as the only way to think about them. The dominance of history, I quote, is derived from the links the idea of history has established with the modern nation state, the secular worldview, the Baconian concept of scientific rationality, 19th century theories of progress, and in recent decades, development. Once exported to the non-modern world, historical consciousness has not only tended to absolutize the past in cultures that have lived with open-ended concepts of the past or depended on myths, legends, and epics to define their cultural selves. It has also made the historical worldview complicit with many new forms of violence, exploitation, and satanism in our times and helped rigidify civilizational, cultural, and national boundaries. Most, end of quote, most available criticisms of history are themselves historical. As in the case of colonial nationalism, which assimilates Orientalism in its own set definition, to be historical in the non-Euro-American world is to rewrite the past under the hegemony of an epistemology that has Eurocentrism built into its very structure. On the other hand, from the same perspective, contemporary efforts in Euro-America to globalize history by writing everyone into it, even in all their differences, appear as little more than effort to contain genuine difference by rendering all societies historical. Nandi concedes that, quote, at one time not long ago, historical consciousness had to coexist with other modes of experiencing and constructing the past, even within the modern world. The conquest of the past through history was still incomplete in the late 19th century, as was the conquest of space through the railways. As long as the non-historical modes thrived, history remained viable as a baseline for radical social criticism. That is perhaps why the great dissenters of the 19th century were the most aggressively historical, end of quote. But such is no longer the case, as the historical way has become the only way of knowing the past, when a critical epistemology has turned into a means of dominance. The point presently is not to find alternative histories, but alternatives to history. We may or may not agree with Nandi's indictment of history, or with the possibility of alternatives to history in a post-historical age. What is most important about his critique, and with other critiques along a similar vein, is that it is the expression of an alternative presence in the dialogue over the past that no longer waits upon a first-world liberal accommodation of other histories, but declares its presence in opposition to the latter, much the same as those Native Americans who, against pleas for the preservation of history and science, demand the return of skeletal remains from museums into the safekeeping of their descendants. Globalization, ultimately, consists of the proliferation of subjects who declare their presence, their contemporary presence, against the erasures of the past or the assimilations of the present. In this very concrete sense, it is, at least from a Euro-American perspective, the end of the world as we have known it, to quote Immanuel Wallerstein. From other perspectives, however, the end may very well signal a new beginning. The challenge is to deal with globalization critically so as to account for the co-presence of both these perspectives in its contradictions as paradigm. While it eschews Eurocentrism, globalization, nevertheless, is continuous with modernization discourse in the teleology of capitalism that is built into it. It perpetuates and justifies both unequal development and unequal power relations, legacies of a colonial modernity that continue to structure the world. It has been used already in some historical work as an excuse to erase the history of colonialism and therefore inequalities of the present that are very much built into contemporary globality. A critical historiography demands that care must be exercised in its deployment as paradigm, not to erase, but to foreground the shaping of the present by the colonial past. I would like to inquire briefly here into the non-hegemonic possibilities offered by globalization as paradigm by taking up a question that has received considerable attention over the last two decades. Modernity as concept has lost much of its coherence as it has become globalized, raising questions concerning both its historical origins and its social, political, and cultural constitution. The incoherence is visible in the historiography of China, both in renewed speculation over the origins of a Chinese modernity and in claims to an alternative modernity. To take up the question of origins, the dominant approach to the question has been to begin modernity with the political and military approach to the question, with the political and military encounter of the 19th century, which also initiated imperialism, nationalism, resistance, cultural transformation, and revolution. This periodization, I may add, has been and is taken for granted by both paradigms under discussion, both in China and in the US. Globalization as paradigm, enforcing a long-term historical perspective, historicizes modern capitalism itself, rather than making it into the given context of history. Similarly, it may also have overcome the teleology of the nation, not by denying its historical significance, as it is fashionable these days with some historians of China, such as Prasenjit Dwara, but by enabling analysis to look past the nation. If I may use a concept that Edward Said proposed, I'm sure everybody is familiar with Edward Said here, the literary critic. Globalizing modern history offers the possibility of worlding Chinese history, bringing Chinese history into the world and bringing the world into Chinese history. Worlding is the opposite of the idea of a Chinese history from the inside or China-centered history proposed by Paul Cohen a decade ago. It requires that we conceptualize history by thinking outside of the nation, with due attention to issues of transnationality and translocality, which also provide a context for historicizing the nation. From this perspective, history from the inside may be read as the last gasp of what one student of mine has called Euro-Sino-centrism. Finally, globalizationist paradigm calls for close attention to the dialectic between structure and history, the relationship between the multiple forces that have structured the modern world and how particular societies have both shaped and been shaped by such structurings. If modernity has anything to do with capitalism, I would like to suggest here, the discussion of modernity needs to inquire further into the relationship between the emergence of capitalism, the restructuring of the world, and the place in it of societies such as China. I mean place in both a temporal and a spatial sense, the place of China in the emergence of capitalism and the place of China in Eurasia and ultimately the globe, which is the irreducible spatial context for the emergence of capitalist modernity. The account of the emergence of capitalism that's most satisfactory does indeed work within these spatial and temporal parameters. The emergence of a single capitalist world system out of a multiplicity of world systems across Eurasia, which would ultimately center on Europe from the 18th century, by which time the whole globe was brought within the purview of this world system. While there had been interactions across Afro-Eurasia since the beginnings of humankind, it's fair to observe, I think, that it was the Mongol invasions that invented Eurasia as we know it. And it is from the Mongol invasions that it's possible to date the emergence of Europe and China, among other empires, from the Mughal to the Safavid to the Ottoman, as we have known them in the modern period. Translocal interactions across Eurasia, nevertheless, produced different formations within a new Eurasian world system. The emergence of capitalism in Western Europe was a product of these interactions within the context of European society. The consequences were different in different parts of Asia, depending on local circumstances. In Eastern Asia, the same period witnessed the consolidation of empire and the formation of China as we have known it with the Ming and the Qing. Initial openness of the early Ming, as witnessed by the Zhenghe expeditions, which are now used as signs of China's globalization from this period on, was followed by greater control over the borders in response to the intensification of pressure from the outside, both on the coast and the interior, perhaps explaining the, quote, defensive expansion, end of quote, throughout the period. This closing out of the world, however, at least the so-called closing out of the world, did not stop significant interactions across the Eastern Asian world system, including cultural interactions as well. Interestingly, given the importance of Central Asian interactions in the formation of East Asia, the Ming and the Qing evinced more interest in this area than in the strangers that showed up with increasing frequency and insistence on the coast. Already, however, the effects of an emergent capitalist world system were evident, if invisibly, in the so-called sprouts of capitalism that Chinese Marxist historians observed in the late Ming. The arrival of Europeans on the China coast led to further defensive closure, especially as European activities turned from assimilation into an Eastern Asian sphere to transforming it in accordance with needs and demands emanating from Europe. By this time, the emergent world system was not just Eurasia, but through the Philippines, included the Americas as well. Ming-Qing efforts to control the borders, however, prevented neither the inflow of commodities nor the emigration to Southeast Asia and beyond of Chinese populations, which also dates back to this period. The transformations wrought by the emergent capitalist world system no doubt provides a context for the simultaneous expansion of Europe and China, although it is important to be attentive to differences as well. The two expansions may both be products of an emerging global world system, but one was empowered by capitalism, the other one a defensive expansion, which, at the very least, was not transformative in its consequences at any scale comparable to the effects of an imperialism empowered by capitalism. These long-term developments provide an indispensable context for understanding 18th, 19th century encounters. From the late 18th century, European imperialism, empowered by the Industrial Revolution, was able to force the Qing to open up to the world system. By the end of the 19th century, the Eastern Asian world system had been incorporated into a global world system, bringing to completion a process that had been underway at least for four centuries. If the above account sounds like containing the history of modern China in a grand narrative or meta-narrative of capitalism, that's only partially true. The narrative I am suggesting is one that begins with the formation of capitalism out of many Eurasian interactions, in which Chinese history, or the history transpiring in the place we call China, played a formative part. It's only with the emergent hegemony of capitalist modernity, apparent from the 18th century, that Chinese history flows into the meta-narrative of capitalism as one of its localized narratives. If this seems like degrading Chinese history from the perspective of those convinced of its exceptionalism, it is worth underlining that European history, too, is localized in this meta-narrative as one of the spatial formations in the globalization of capital, albeit with a hegemonic part to play in the emergence of modernity. The problem in this expanded paradigm of modernity is how to reconcile structure and history, or the grand narrative and the local narratives. The paradigm presents a second problem that involves the very question of modernity. Modernity appears here in two guises, as a set of relationships and as a substantial social formation with at least some definable characteristics that were first realized in Europe and spread therefrom around the world, more often than not with the force of arms. The one suggests that all who entered these relationships must of necessity be viewed as modern, as each made some contribution to the modern as it unfolded over the centuries. This is a position that could be identified with some versions of postcolonial criticism. The other identifies modernity with the forms it took in Europe, not merely as developments from within an autonomous European history, as in Eurocentrism, but with all its entanglements in the history of capitalism and colonialism. Alternative possibilities of development that emerged elsewhere, where they were not erased, disappeared into a Eurocentric modernity as the latter established its domination and hegemony. As the hegemony of Europe and North America recedes in our day, claims to alternative modernities are once again on the resurgence, but this time around in forms filtered through two centuries of Eurocentric modernity, now globalized in its effects. The repudiation of teleologies, or the claim to multiple teleologies linking different pasts and presents, has also deprived the future of any kind of coherence that might permit convincing adjudication of competing interpretations. The crisis now is not just a paradigm crisis, but a crisis of history itself. But the crisis may also provide an opportunity that has been created by the retreat of historical determinisms of various kinds, foregrounding the importance of humans making their own history, not arbitrarily, but still making it under given conditions. The paradigm I have suggested above may be helpful in this regard. While it centers capitalism as the structuring force of modernity, it rejects centering the structure around any particular history, drawing attention to the multiplicity of histories that went into the making of modernity and the multiplicity of histories that are on the emergence from its ruins. It may be possible in this perspective to once again bring into visibility not only the variety for phenomena produced by modernity, but also the many histories that were erased under the regime of modernity, that may now be brought into play in challenging the hegemony of a colonial modernity. The challenge may also be crucial to human survival and the crises that have attended the globalization of capitalist modernity. The challenge to the hegemonic teleology of capitalist modernity needs to undertake most immediately a challenge to developmentalism that has driven this teleology. If I may return here to Ashish Nandi. Nandi has argued in his many works that we consider not just alternative modernities, but alternatives to modernity. The reconsideration must also allow for a quest for alternatives to history, as history has been part of the ideological structure of modernity with its erasure of pre- and non-modern. That means that the narrativization of modernity must be particularly attentive to the local narratives that also undermine the narrative of modernity, something that may be possible only if we recast our vision beyond nation and region to the global, which is also the location for the narrative of capitalist modernity. Is it possible that considerations of alternatives to modernity is necessary for a national development that's truly free of the legacies of colonial modernity, that can freely write its future. To speak of freedom in the writing of the future is to bring back utopianism. But do we not need a utopianism that imagines an alternative to the disguised utopianism of the present that informs all modernization discourse, bourgeois or revolutionary? A capitalist modernity that the promises of which are continuously deferred to the future, while in reality its destructive effects bring disaster to millions, if not billions, and promise to destroy humanity by destroying the very earth that we call home. This utopianism would call forth not only the rewriting of history, but reconceptualizing the social and political entities which provide the units of history, as well as the concepts of time and space around which we organize the past, the present, and the future. Utopianism does not require that we reject history either. What it demands is that we rescue from the past alternative modes of living and producing that have been erased under the regime of a modernizationist history of either a bourgeois or of a socialist kind. We need not be carried away by utopianism. If the vision of a different kind of society enables us to see in the past alternatives that have been erased by a modernizationist history, those alternatives, as realities of the past, may help us bring some sense of reality into utopianism itself and not let it degenerate into arbitrary and subjective willfulness that may be as harmful as the modernity it proposes to overcome. Tomorrow evening I will take up what I believe are contemporary efforts in the People's Republic of China to deal with this problem. But for now, thank you very much for your patience.
Well, thank you, Professor. You could come back to the chair so that you prefer to stand there. Okay, I think the what follows is question and answer session for about 20 minutes. I think it's okay, we'll pass on the mic, okay, and then when they right, you please raise your hand if you have a question, and then we'll give you the mic. It's working.
First, I would like to thank Professor Rick in his admirable effort in giving us the perspective and the reflections. I would like to continue the quest, if I might, that in the demarcation of barriers and boundaries, or
demarcation of
barriers and boundaries.
Boundaries.
Okay. Now, I'll put the firstly the discourse on revolution. I would always say that technologically is the prime force for revolution, like the printing press, right? Mm-hmm. Like, but then, in the other lectures, in the beginning of the Hong Kong University series, I stressed on EPS, the edifying pedagogic structure. Now, you talk about the restructuring, right? The restructuring of the world order. Like, if we take Pax Britannica, right? Okay? Then you got a new order, the new Roman order. Mm-hmm. As Nietzschean critique would say, it's just like Greco-Roman logos, right? Now this thinking is in line with what we are talking about, right? Like corporatism, Fordism, populists of the Russian or Soviet influence at the beginning of last century, right? Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is, I would like to stress on a demarcation on two levels. The duality. Now, the Cold War, post-war, post-WW1 and WW2, and post-CW, PCW. And we can see that the demarcation in two levels. One is what I would call the justified actualization level. And the second would be you've been using technologically, right? I would put it in the 21st century, we should and always have to look back. Like you just have this ecological approach, right? The appeal. Now we should look back on Earth, our planet Earth, always for the resources, no matter it's logistics or whatever, that the water may become a very, very precious commodity, right?
Could I ask Derek
I've overrun a little bit, okay. But I want to reflect on this. May we say that in view of all this, actually, we were talking about globalization in its problematics, right, in the 80s. But it's only feasible. Like Heidegger, like Francis Fukuyama, they all put it into perspective that we should look, really, try something like a strategy in dealing with planet Earth. Thank you.
In dealing with?
Planet Earth.
Planet Earth.
Yes,
even more broader than your macro history.
Well, I'll
reserve something for
who could not agree with that statement? Especially after this most recent news from the United Nations, which really should not be news to. I tend to be pessimistic. And those of us who are pessimistic did not need any kind of report from the United Nations to know that something dreadful is coming at us. We talk about globalization. There's a certain kind of utopianism about globalization itself. And I actually argued in my recent book that globalization has already happened. It's not, it's given to us as a promise, as something in the future. But it has already happened, and it's really, in hindsight, it's sort of like the Owl of Minerva coming out at dusk. After it has happened, now we are calling it globalization. What I see in the world now is endless fragmentation. But that, too, we can put aside. And I think that the future is coming at us very rapidly. This is how I look at the question of resources now. People, of course, mention, people like Michael Clare have insisted on this, oil and water are the two major resources. Air may be another one that's coming at us, And the question is, I don't know if this is what you had in mind with your reference to technology at the beginning. In the United States, of course, the U.S. leadership, certain groups in the U.S. leadership are committed to the idea that the problems of technology can be resolved through more technology. And I'm afraid that this has become global in many ways, looking at what's going on in the People's Republic of China. Faith, and this is the faith that I referred to in the paper as developmentalism, the endless development. Whereas my inclination has always been that the social context for technology is important. And if we are going to resolve the question of resources, ecology, etc., it's going to it will have to involve changes in our ways of living, which means we'll have to change the social relations. At least this is what I feel about what's going on.
All right. And then any more questions? I think.
Yes, ma'am.
I would like to ask, do you think globalization will destroy the culture of the nations?
Do I think so? Some people say it will, other people say it won't. To give you the thing, I'm editing a volume right now on certain developments in contemporary China, the People's Republic of China, and I have an article from a colleague who is also a very respected intellectual within the Communist Party, and of course the party is convinced that since the party is committed to globalization. It also argues, however, that Chinese culture will be saved. In fact, one of the responses to globalization has been an insistence on Chinese culture. Okay. Now, my sense of this is that I will refer to that section of the paper where I was talking about the emergence of nationalism from the late 19th century on. My understanding of this, not just for China but everywhere, is that the idea of a national culture itself is a colonialist idea. In other words, what I said in passing in that thing, that national cultures emerge by suppressing local cultures. Just as we are now saying that, your question, will globalization destroy national culture? We can all say that national cultures destroy local cultures in order to become national cultures. And one of the interesting phenomena about globalization, the way I look at it, is that by engaging in a certain kind of assault on the nation state and the idea of the nation as a unit of analysis, it has in fact allowed for the emergence of localized cultures. The rearticulation of localized cultures which makes nation states very nervous and they engage in suppression. I don't think I have to pursue the argument too far in the case of Chinese societies, which in their variety call into question the idea of a Chinese culture. But having said that, I mean, with whatever level we are talking about, whether we are talking about the national level or the local level, etc., these cultures are cultures in the process of transformation anyway. In other words, the world does not have to become a homogeneous place in order for cultures to be transformed, right? Cultures can be transformed and create new kinds of diversities, new kinds of differences. And I think this is happening. I mean, the contemporary claims to culture, whether it's at the civilizational level, if you like, if we listen to somebody like Samuel Huntington or his liberal counterparts, Samuel Huntington may come from one political perspective, but he has got his liberal and even radical counterparts among some of the postcolonial critics they tend to reify culture at the civilizational level. Although Huntington will recognize that what is called fundamentalism these days, or Islamic culture, or a Confucian culture, etc., is already a product of modernity. I mean, I myself suggested in a critique of the issue of Confucianism and capitalism that many of the contemporary interpretations of Confucianism are informed by Weberian notions of what Confucianism should be. So in a way, they are a reinterpretation of Confucianism from very modern perspectives to create a new kind of Confucianism. So whatever these levels may be, I think we are in the process of generating new cultures. And my question here, I mean, if that is indeed the case as a hypothesis that we can... Then my question is not how to generate new national cultures or civilizational cultures, etc., but how can we generate out of the storehouse of past values, wherever those values may come from, whether they come from Lunyu, or whether they come from the Quran, or whether they they come from the Enlightenment, that how we can in fact out of these create new cultures that perhaps serve human ends rather than national or civilizational ends, because I think we already have too much of the national and civilizational cultures. And my reference is sometimes I feel like a reactionary, you know, that you talk about the possibilities of... let me explain that by stepping back a minute, there was a time, it's only 20, 25 years ago, you know, so long as socialism, let's say, was a viable proposition for the future, a future kind of utopianism, you know, that it was possible to place yourself in the future and criticize contemporary society from an imagined future, an imagined utopia. This has become almost impossible as the future has been fragmented. So in a way, what the reactionary position is that the past is almost all we have in coming up with the critique of the present. And of course, the past comes in many forms. You know, for some some people would like to. Would like to revive the past in toto. There are people like that in China. I'm of Turkish origin. There are people who want to revive an imagined Turkish culture from the past or anything. But there's one past that I think might be useful, and this is why I spent so much time in the paper talking about Ashish Nandi. That Indian scholars have invested quite a bit of effort in examining technologies that were available that were suppressed with industrial modernization. You know, technologies that were more human scale technologies that were devoted to local needs, whatever, than the needs of global capital, etc. Now, is this a possibility? Is this something is this an area where we can, in fact, learn something from the past in understanding the present? And in that case, how should we rewrite the past to foreground these things rather than writing the past as this inevitable march of modern capitalist economy? That's the problem that has been bothering me. That's the problem to which I have been paying some attention recently. Anyway, okay.
Hello, Professor. Can you hear me? And in the two world wars, the Nazi people tried to exterminate the Jewish people, and they tried to genocide the Jewish people. And so under the ideology of globalization, do you think the term good genes and bad genes, and good race and bad race still exist? Thank you.
Good race and bad race?
Good genes and bad genes.
Well, people talk about it. I mean, before we get into good and the bad, you drive me into an area where I have little expertise. But let me respond to hearsay, as we all hear it. First, do people believe in genes and collectivities based around genes? Since we were talking about the culture thing a minute ago, I've always been intrigued by a statement in Lin Pan's book, Children of the Yellow Emperor, her study of the Chinese diaspora, where she says she says to talk to some people in Singapore, you would think that Chineseness was built into people's genes. So the idea of Chineseness itself has become a very problematic idea for me. But I'm afraid that more and more people talk about this kind of thing that you probably have heard about all this, with these child adoptions, for instance. A couple of years ago, there were people in in Russia, you know, there are a lot of children in trouble, right? But some people came out against foreign adoptions of Russian children on the grounds that it was depleting the Russian gene pool, whatever that may be. You know, how do you identify Russia with a particular gene pool? My fear is that, it's the title of a recent book, The Globalization of Racism. That in fact racism, rather than disappearing, is one of the gifts of globalization to us. That more and more people think more and more along racial lines. Paul Gilroy, British scholar now in the United States, he once said a very pithy statement that it's almost like a biologization of culture. Even when we talk about cultural phenomena, you know, when you talk about national culture, etc., people speak of these things as if culture was a biological phenomenon, that it was incorporated into their genes. And as far as I'm concerned, racism is one of those things that we have to fight against, wherever it comes from. Because it is, yes, it is there. People talk about it more and more, they escape into race against some of these forces of anxieties about globalization, whatever. But I think it's a problem. That's what I see.
All right. I think that the good and bad and the ugly, I have to be the ugly person, I think, as a timekeeper. I think maybe I allow the last question. I think that's... There's a hand over there. And tomorrow you come and I'll remember you, okay?
I'll talk less tomorrow.
Thank you, Professor. Right. Yes, Professor Derek, Turkey and China went through the process of the making of modern nationalism about the same time. How would you...
Turkey and China?
Turkey and China, yes.
Oh, that is a huge question.
So could you just briefly comment?
Okay, could I ask the lady to raise her question, because I thought she was the one, but then you listen to the two questions and then you...
Let me listen to both of them.
I will remember the gentleman there, okay.
I just wonder, for the colonized, for example, the middle class or in the colonized, among them, there were the middle class or the elites in the colonized. So I wonder how they were put into your paradigm.
Thank you. Okay, very quickly we can come back to it. In the 1930s, as you well know, that under the Kuomintang, Turkey was sort of like a model. For the Kuomintang, you know, with Kemal Atatürk, Can Çeşen, Atatürk was one of the models to follow. Now, presently, China has become a model for Turkey. You know, the Chinese talk about PRC, about the 21st century being a Chinese century. I hear there's talk in Turkey that the 21st century is going to be a Turkish century. So I think, you know, we've got to be very careful about this, right? That's part of it. Secondly, for the colonized, I think that one of the transformations that have come with globalization, that's why I think globalization is not simply a continuation of earlier colonialism or imperialism, is that there is the emergence of what others have called, Leslie Sclair, I think, was the first one to use it, the transnational capitalist class. I think that there is a ruling class on the emergence, the globalization of a ruling class that includes not just people from Euro-America, but from the formerly colonized societies, so that those class differences are becoming global along with other things. I hope that answers your question here briefly. Yeah.
Well, I think the professor keeps the time right. So for those who wanted to raise questions, would you please come tomorrow, and then I'll mark your name down first, okay? And it's I know that tonight is a heavy intellectual meal, and some would probably get indigestion, and then some will be got very excited and stimulated. But then please do, I think, come tomorrow at 7, and then the focus will be on globalization and also on national development in China. All right, let's thank Professor Derek once again. Thank you very much for coming tonight.
Thank you.